Hello, and welcome to this podcast. And this podcast is to mark International Day of the Girl Child. My name's Simon Wright, and I'm head of child survival at Save the Children. And it's 3 months since there was a very important meeting in London called the Family Planning Summit, which the UK government and DFID hosted. And it had the ostensive aim to increase commitments and resources so that 120 million more women and girls could use contraception by 2020. And it was calculated that this would result in 200,000 fewer women and girls dying as a result of pregnancy and childbirth, and nearly 3 million fewer infants dying in their first year of life. Now, with me to discuss this is Nicola Jones, and Nicola is ODI Research Fellow, and she's the author of a report that ODI did with Save the Children called Charting the Future, Empowering Girls to Prevent Early Pregnancy. And also with me is Lakshmi Sundaram, and she's Executive Director of Girls Not Brides. And Girls Not Brides is a global partnership of over 180 organisations, which is working to end child marriage all over the world. Now, the reason that ODI and Save the Children did this report was because we felt that as well as looking at the amount of money and the amount of resources and family planning services, we needed to also talk about some of the really important barriers that actually stop a lot of women and young girls from coming forward for accessing contraception, or that drives births to very young girls. And approximately 18 million girls under the age of 20 give birth each year, and 16 million of that 18 million are 15 to 19, and 2 million of those are under the age of 15. Nearly all of them, of course, or 95%, are in the developing world, and the vast majority of them are married, at least 9 in 10. So the reason why we need to look at this is that we know that women giving birth at a very young age is quite harmful. It's harmful to their own health, and it's definitely harmful to the health of their babies. It sets up a pattern of multiple births as well, all of which we know is a cycle of poor health and high levels of morbidity and mortality. So the question, which is very contentious, and it was at the summit, is what do you actually do if you're going to try and change some of that culture? Because a lot of the women would say that they have made some choices, that if they're married, they want to have children. And one of the interviewees for Nicola's report said, actually, when they were asked, do you feel that, you know, you got married early and had babies early as a result of discrimination? They said, it's not discrimination, it's my culture. So this is a tough question about how we make some changes to culture around the world. And I've got a question, really, that I'm going to pose both to Nicola and to Lakshmi. And the first question is really, how should we try and change cultural practices that perpetuate gender inequalities and therefore restrict young girls and women's access to their reproductive rights?
I think this is really a critical question, Simon. What's really striking to us at ODI is the fact that up to 3/4 of these teen pregnancies that you are mentioning in the developing world are intended. Often we think that it's accidental, there's a lot of preaching about abstinence, but actually when we realise that most of these girls are married and they're intending to have children, then obviously we've got to start tackling those attitudes from the outset. Commodities are part of the question, but only a very limited part of that. So in our report, we identify really 5 key dimensions of empowerment, so ways that girls can be empowered to start overcoming some of these barriers they face both within the household and within their communities. So the first dimension we look at is about addressing some of the sociocultural stereotypes that drive child marriage, dowry practice, and domestic violence, because all of these types of attitudes and practices really exacerbate girls' limited decision-making power within the household and over their own bodies. And I think what's really frightening is that evidence tells us that girls really are able to negotiate sex in such contexts. So nearly 1/3 of young brides report being forced into sex by their husbands, and in many countries an equivalent percentage report that that's their first sexual experience. So I think this is very troubling and something we need to pay much more attention to. And so in the report we document a number of interesting initiatives working with community leaders and then via media and especially new communication technologies such as mobile phones, which as we all know are increasingly widespread, even in very remote places in the developing world. And so these kinds of media or outreach programs can highlight the risks for girls and their offspring associated with early marriage and pregnancy, and also just how important it is to have more decision-making over their fertility and to plan and space their children. And the second dimension relates to interpersonal empowerment, so it's very related. And in the report, we quote the case of a young Indian woman who was married at the age of 19, and she believes that her husband has total control over her childbearing. She says that he not only has the right to decide how many children she has, but also when they should have them, and even, she believes, whether they're boys or girls. What we try and emphasize is that this is not an exceptional story. These beliefs are quite widespread throughout many places in Africa and South Asia, that women are not, and young girls are not able to use contraception if they want to because of this lack of permission from their husbands. And when you think about it, motherhood is really seen as the final sort of sign of moving into adulthood and serves as a foundation for status in the family and community. So I think this is really critical to address. We need to think about how women and girls can be empowered both within their birth families but also in their marital families. But I think it's really important just to highlight a third area. We talk a lot about the importance of girls having access to education, which is obviously critical, but we also need very practical education on family planning. So girls need to be empowered with age-appropriate school-based sex education when they're still in schools, ideally starting early in primary school before they drop out, so that they know not just about biology but also what they can do to support themselves when making these types of decisions. And at the same time, I think sexual and reproductive health providers really need to be supported to shift their attitudes as well. Many girls that are included in the report talked about feeling shamed when they went to such health providers rather than feeling empowered and supported for dealing maturely with their sexuality. So I think this is another area that really could help shift some of these cultural problems.
And could I just ask, I mean, one assumption might be that changing legislation in countries is key to removing some of that discrimination that we're then seeing the effects. Do you think in lots of cases the legislation is fine but the culture is still lagging behind? Or, I mean, do you think there is still a legislative change agenda that we need to follow?
Definitely. I mean, I think there are some countries where sort of affirmative action and gender empowerment legislation still needs to be tightened. But actually, in most countries we looked at, the formal legislation was quite strong, but then there's a lack of harmonization between traditional and religious legal codes as well, which are often very important. So I think that harmonization process is key. And then supporting people in the justice system to actually implement it. Many of them aren't even aware that these laws are on the books, or if so, how they can actually practically go about empowering girls with these rights.
I think that's a very important point, because we've seen that Swaziland announced that they're going to ban child marriage. I don't know exactly what that means in reality in law, but of course that's still a long way from making changes. So Lakshmi Sundaram from McGirls Not Brides, could you maybe tell us a little bit of how you think we should be trying to approach that change that we need to achieve at cultural level if we're going to reduce early marriage and early pregnancy?
So Girls Not Brides was set up by the Elders. And the Elders are a group of independent global leaders who work together on peace and human rights. The group was set up by Nelson Mandela and is currently chaired by Archbishop Tutu. And when setting up Girls Not Brides, the Elders repeatedly said that traditions are made by people, and if they are harmful and have outlived their usefulness, they must change. And it's people that can change traditions. And there's actually an increasing body of evidence now that shows that harmful social norms and cultural practices can and do change. But they can only change if they're addressed in a holistic manner. As Nicola mentioned, there are many factors at play here, and this is critical. So you need a combination of the legal frameworks that you just mentioned, but also the development of alternative options for the girls and their families, as well as dialogues with communities, and this is critical. Focusing on just one aspect may not actually lead to the desired outcome. So one example, UNICEF did some research into how and why the prevalence of female genital mutilation came down in different parts of the world. They actually found that simply focusing on the negative health implications of the practice sometimes had the effect of pushing parents to go to doctors to perform the procedure, and in a way normalized the procedure. However, programs that also explicitly looked at girls' rights and empowered them and their families, those resulted in lasting change. So for Girls Not Brides and for our members, this type of analysis is incredibly valuable as we look at ways to end child marriage around the world.
I think it's really interesting to hear about that there are some examples of countries that have been able to achieve that kind of change. And Nicola, could you maybe tell us a little bit about how you think they have done it, if there are some countries that have really been able to bring up the age of marriage and bring up the age of first child and perhaps the number of children as well?
Looking at sort of cases of good news stories is really important. So here, I think it's probably really worthwhile highlighting some programs that work with men and boys to sort of change norms of masculinity or what it means to be a man in a particular culture. And so Program H, which started in Brazil, I think is a really great example that's now being picked up in South Asia as well. And they're working with adolescent boys and young men to get them to rethink what it means to be a strong and successful male in their community. So that involves rethinking, you know, to what extent you undertake work within the household, to what extent you share decisions about reproductive health and also childcare. And they've done that both through sort of you know, youth clubs, but then also very attractive and culturally resonant media campaigns, you know, billboards, radio, TV programs in particular. I mean, that's one thing that sort of came out quite strongly in our research. It's often these sort of cultural initiatives, you know, even soap operas in Latin America being very effective, and now that's being picked up similarly in India, that are really reaching out not just to girls, but actually trying to bring in men and boys.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you do hear sometimes a criticism that gender work ends up focusing on men and boys again, and all the attention and the resources and some of the work ends up on those groups instead of looking at girls and women, how they can be empowered. Lakshmi, how do you think, if you look at the totality, how do you think a country could try to empower girls to have more choice around marriage, around childbirth?
So again, picking up on Nicola's point of working with men and boys, I do think it's a combination of not exclusively focusing on men and boys or women and girls, but really trying to design programs that address the needs of both. I think the reason there's been an interest in working with men and boys now is because traditionally programs involving gender empowerment have really just focused on women and girls and have created some sort of tension within communities because there was this feeling that it was one against the other, as opposed to communities working all together to uplift the women within the community, the girls within the community, and therefore the entire community itself. So one of our members is an organization called Blue Veins based in Pakistan, and this organization was actually set up by a young Pakistani man, initially focused on breast cancer, and now the organization has moved on to work on a variety of issues around violence against women and child marriage and various issues. And actually, Blue Veins' work with men and boys came as a result of their realization that what they were trying to do was having a negative impact, because in a sense, by just working with women and girls, they sometimes had the unintended consequence of endangering the women and girls who were involved in the program, because the communities and their male relatives would sometimes see this as a bit of an affront. So Blue Veins then started working with various leaders and with men's groups and boys' groups within the community, particularly prayer leaders within mosques, to really try and make this more of a community issue than just one focused on the women and girls.
Nicola, obviously we've talked about making sure that the age of consent, the age of marriage, the legal situation in terms of women can divorce, all these factors are very important in terms of whether girls are empowered. But what about the sort of cultural changes that we could try and make through education? Are there other kind of structural changes we can make that could make a real difference?
Yeah, I mean, I think education is something that we can't emphasize enough. I mean, in some ways, I think there's a risk now that MDG 2 and 3 have been so successful compared to the others, the Millennium Development Goals focusing on education, that we may lose sight of the fact that actually many girls are still out of school. So I think cash transfer programs that enable families to then provide access to children, both girls and boys, to education and health services are really critical. Scholarships which support girls, particularly at secondary school level, have been found to be particularly vital in South Asia, where it's helped to reduce pressures on early marriage. Then even school feeding schemes. So for example, in contexts like Mali or Senegal, then providing pupils not just with meals at school, but also then food supplies that they can take back home has been really critical.
So it's important to look at the totality of girls' needs and the situations in which they're living, and that's affecting the choices that they're making in terms of whether they're going into marriage, whether they've got freedom to make some choices, or whether they have to follow the desires and the norms that they've been given from the rest of their society. Lakshmi, the Family Planning Summit was really interesting because while we've got DFID with a very strong focus at the moment on wanting to count results of its projects and its programmes, we also had DFID talking about the importance of empowering girls and women. And that's quite hard to reconcile, because how do you measure those kind of cultural changes, which surely take quite a long time, as opposed to counting the number of access to long-acting contraceptives that are being used in a country?
The issue of measuring empowerment and measuring how social norms change is indeed incredibly difficult. But I have to say, there is a body of work that is addressing this issue, and there are a number of programs that are in place that have been set up with this question of monitoring and evaluation built in. For instance, there's a project called TESFA in Ethiopia that CARE is implementing with ICRW. There's a program in India called Prachar, which works with young married girls and tests different approaches to promoting health and empowerment together, and really trying to measure the effect of that. The Berhan Hewan program in Ethiopia has also been a project that's had incredibly good results. It has resulted in an increase in the proportion of girls who demonstrate knowledge about contraception, and also in the use of contraception by sexually active girls. So it is difficult, yes, but it can be done. The issue, I think, is to make sure that donors and others who are evaluating these programs are aware of what it takes, first of all, to evaluate, but also that rights-based change doesn't happen overnight. It's a long-term process, particularly if you want change that is sustainable and that is durable. So I think from the donor community or from the evaluator community, if you will, that's something to really keep in mind, that social norms do change, but to measure their change takes time.
Just to complement what Lakshmi was saying, I think, I mean, given that there's such a hunger right now for evidence-based policy making and programming, then donors could really draw on some quite interesting data sets that already exist and sort of complementing the program evaluations on empowerment that Lakshmi was talking about. So there's the OECD Social Institutions and Gender Index, which I think is really critical in providing an international view on attitudes towards sun bias, to gender-based violence, to discriminatory legal codes, so some of those key things we were talking about earlier on. And then also, I think we can't forget the demographic and health surveys. So they're undertaken every couple of years in all countries around the world, and they're increasingly looking at attitudes towards reproductive health, to contraceptive use, and even to sort of sexual violence within the household. So I think if we can sort of build on some of these broader initiatives as well, then we could really go a long way in meeting this hunger for more evidence-based programming.
Thank you. The report, Charting the Future, which is on the ODI website and on the Save the Children website, has a real wealth of information in here, and there's a number of things we haven't touched on, such as the fact that, of course, you need services. You need those services to be accessible to women and girls. You can't have it restricted just to married women. You need it provided in times and places, and the barrier of cost is an enormous barrier, as we know, that expecting the very poorest communities, women in the very poorest communities, to be able to afford to pay for reproductive health commodities does not work, and we know that. There's lots of very strong evidence of that. But also it tells us really that aside from just thinking that we can just give people information, give people the kind of leaflet, the behaviour change communication that will automatically lead to that kind of change, those ideas are fairly discredited now really. And I think this report shows us really strongly that you've got to look at the social factors, you've got to look at the agency, you've got to look at what is driving the culture in a country that is meaning that women are going into marriage at a very early age, having many children from a very young age, and that their health and the health of their babies is not being taken as the overall priority. And I think the lesson that's come out of this as well is that that isn't something that short-term aid projects can measure. It's something that's got to have a long-term commitment to development and to social change in those countries. And that's something we need the donors to think about as well. Lakshmi, Nicola, thank you very much.